Welcome to HER, the Health Equity and Reflection Podcast, an AMWA and C. Carter Fellowship production, where we hope to inform and uplift female changemakers in global health. This is a production of the Ann C. Carter Global Health Fellows. All views and opinions are those of the individuals and not AMWA itself. Thank you for tuning in to this fireside chat episode of HER, the Health, Equity, and Reflection Podcast. In this episode, you'll hear an interview with an inspirational leader in global health, their origins, current projects and initiatives, and advice that they'd give their younger self.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Nora. I'm currently a third-year student at the University of South Florida Morsani College of Medicine. This is my second year of the Ann C. Carter Fellowship. Today, I have the joy of getting to speak with Professor Nora Gross. Professor Gross is an endowed chair and the head of the Disability Research Center at University College London. She's a decades-long history of wonderful disability advocacy and research in the field of medical anthropology and disability and global health. And we are very lucky to have her today. So, all right, wonderful. And with that, we'll get started. All right, so this is for the American Medical Women's Association Ann C. Carter Global Health Fellowship. And please join me in welcoming Professor Gross. Thank you so much for being here. I kind of want to talk both about the work that you do and like career trajectory. You have such a wonderful career, but you also do things like balance positions at two different institutions and sit on like committees. And so I think I'd like to talk a little bit about that maybe towards the end, just in terms of like, how do you, as like a little baby academic, how do you do this? But first, I think I want to talk about the big stuff. So you do really interesting work at the intersection of global health and disability. And I wanted to know more about what drew you to that.
By training, I am an anthropologist. And though I'd be called a medical anthropologist now or an applied anthropologist. In fact, I have a broad training in anthropology, and I got my degree many years ago, long before there were such things as applied anthropologists, and even there wasn't much in the way of international development, global health point. This was in the late 70s, early 1980s. And as a component of that, I didn't set out to work in disability per se. What happened as, and this is a case for lots of reasons, is I kind of stumbled into something and then things continued on from there. As an anthropologist and as someone who did a lot of oral history, I spent a lot of time in rural New England doing initial field work. I was very interested in old communities and came across a community on the island of Martha's Vineyard with a very high rate of hereditary deafness. My PhD dissertation, I did a study of this island. It was an inherited form of deafness. There were many inherited deafness when I started in the genetics literature. A few people had asked a basic anthropological question, which is how did people with disabilities fare in a community, in a small town such as the one I was looking at. And it turned out on Martha's Vineyard, the entire community, most of the hearing people, the vast majority, for about 250 years became bilingual in English and sign language, not because they were being nice, but because it was a smart thing to do. It'd be like growing up on the Tex-Mex border today and not speaking Spanish. You don't have to speak Spanish, but your life is a lot easier if you do. And so when I finished that study and published it, it turned out it was right in the early 1980s, and it was right as the American Disability Rights Movement was getting going. And lots of people in the Disability Rights Movement were beginning to say, it's not us, it's a surrounding society. It was kind of an incipient social model. And a lot of the medical community and the politicians and the, you know, media were saying, you know, of course it's you, because, you know, no place in the world does people with disabilities. And here I was, a new PhD student. I got my degree at Brown University in Rhode Island, and I wandered into this controversy, and I found an example of adapted to disability, and it wasn't in some far-flung Pacific atoll someplace. It was 80 miles from Boston. So I suddenly found myself very much in the middle of the disability rights movement in the United States. And the more I got involved, came to speak with folks who were part of the disability rights movement, to do research and advocacy, the more I got involved in disability as a component of what I wanted to do in global health, in part because I hate it when things are unfair. So I'm not disabled myself, but it just seemed to me that people who were disabled were being denied anything in society because of their disability, when it was clearly that, you know, that they were being barred from education and employment and, you know, even the right to vote at that point in some, you know, in mm-hmm. some places. So that's, I guess, how I got involved. Get out to do disability per se. But over the years, I've set up and then run the global health program at Yale University for about 20 years, for example. But I keep coming back to disability because I guess, first of all, the things with disabilities face are so unjust. And second of all, I really like the people in the field, all the disability advocates I work with, and they like to cause trouble, and I trouble. It's a common meeting ground. So yeah. Apologies for the long answer.
No, I love it. And I wanted to agree, because I've only been in the field for a few years of disability advocacy, but I can also attest to the fact that disability advocates are very tough and are willing to push. And it's, again, one of the things I love about them, like you were saying, because it's like, great, let's go, let's do this. Like, it's that attitude, and I love it.
You know, it's like committed people, but you don't have to be a person with a disability. Not all people with disabilities have to be advocates, but
yes,
benefit by what advocates do. You know, just so you shouldn't have to. If you know, you should be able to do anything you want as a person with a disability. You shouldn't have to fight a battle every day. But for most people with disabilities, at some level or another, they're fighting a battle every day, mm-hmm. and we can't ignore that.
I wanted to talk, but I don't want to move away from this because it's so interesting, but I do want to talk a little bit about your research itself. You did some, when we first talked, you were telling me about some of the work you did with HIV, AIDS, and disability, and I was reading some of that last night. And what I loved is that you called out the, like, immediately how this work doesn't get done because there's a societal expectation, especially I think Western, but you may correct me on that, that people with disabilities are not people that have sex and therefore like are overlooked, and it's a health population that we need to take care of and look at.
I've done a whole range of things.
Yeah. One of the papers. Yeah.
Nutrition, and I've done a lot with, I did a big project, and I'm coming back to another big project on people and begging on the streets, and, you mm-hmm. know, and poverty, but certainly with sexual and reproductive health, people with disabilities had been left out of just every component mm-hmm. of sexual and reproductive health issues, and that's because there was an assumption for many years that they were not mm-hmm. sexually active. In fact, we know now that people with disabilities are as sexually active as the rest of the population. You need not just, you know, not only all the surveys and stuff, you look at birth rates among, mm-hmm. you know, the number of children people with disabilities have, or the number, it's all very clear. But in the been going for several years before I kind of woke up one day and said, wait a minute, I never see anything on people with disabilities in sexual and reproductive health. And when it comes to AIDS, I would expect, and it turned out to be the case, that they were more at risk than the general population, not because they were more sexually active, but because of any range of things. They weren't getting the information. They weren't getting the, you know, things like condoms for them to get. They weren't being included in any of the major outreach efforts that were going on around AIDS and AIDS prevention. And so from any number angles, it was, it was like, we're talking about 15% of the world's population, 16%. Mm-hmm. Population. It's hard to overlook that. When we started the research we did, I actually got a small grant from Judy Heumann, who had just been appointed when I started this project, and she and I kind of did the project together. She had just gotten that job at the World Bank, where she was the first person setting up a disability component at the World Bank. And she called me up, and she had like, I forget what it was, like $15,000 or $20,000 to spare, and what would I do with it? And I said, well, I do some work on AIDS and disability, and we started. Actually, it was, the internet was relatively new. I feel so old and saying relatively new, and so we did what we set up a survey. We called it the Global Survey, or like the Global Survey on AIDS and Disability. The Global Survey looks suspiciously like me and two of my grad students at Yale, who just emailed everyone we could think of. We emailed about 7,000 people and institutions, every head of HIV AIDS projects we could think of, lots of people in UNAIDS. And we interviewed some people, including the head of UNAIDS, sent it to lots of disability advocacy groups. In any case, we got a lot of feedback, and almost every place the answer was the same, which is, oh, we never thought of that. At one point, we were going to call it the "Oh, we never thought of it" survey. But it kind of raised the bar and raised the tension. And now, this was many years ago. Since then, there's been a number of studies, bigger studies, smaller studies, and some very excellent studies on the impact of HIV and AIDS on people with disabilities. UNAIDS finally was pushed into including people with disabilities in their 5-year plan. So, their newest 5-year plan has it. So it's gone from, now it's not a rare, broader topics are not just AIDS, but sexual and reproductive health overall. Mm-hmm. The choice for people with disabilities to decide when or if they have children, whether they protect themselves and have safe sex or safer sex, that should be a component of any discussion of, and not just discussion around disability, but also still young people with disabilities are often not getting this information at the same rate as their non-disabled peers. Disabled women often don't get the information at the same rate as their non-disabled women. And in fact, disabled men often are never, given information. In many societies, boys and men pick up, girls get some talk, either to keep them chaste or to deal with menstruation or to make sure that, they get pregnant at a certain time or something. Boys and men often don't get that information at all. They pick information on sexual and reproductive health through jokes and innuendos and banter.
Okay, so, the ideal way of learning, right?
No. That's right, But for many men with disabilities, especially I found that men with intellectual disabilities, it's hard for them to pick up information this way. Mm-hmm. And so getting information on sexual and reproductive health up to and including safety around things like AIDS is something that we need to think about. So it's not just women. Disabled men also need this information.
I love that point, and I love that you took that from, like, I mean, obviously not that this paper is a small thing, but you took it from the point we were talking about and could expand out, because you're right. Like, we're talking about this specific topic, but we're talking about it because it exists in a larger, like, dearth of information and, like, a larger systemic issue that's, like, truly international, because the things you're saying are echoed in the things I hear at, like, the national disability, like, advocacy level, and I know exist in healthcare here, and, like, it's really interesting to hear the nuance of it all. And I wanted to tie that to another paper of yours that I read last night, because I went down a rabbit hole about these attitudes are a pressure, women with disabilities' perceptions of how stigma shapes their sexual health choices. And one thing that I found really interesting in this paper that I was hoping you could talk to is I had just read, I don't know if you're familiar with this, it's a book called We've Got This, which is like essays by disabled parents. It's all about disabled parents in the...
Okay. I've seen that.
But it's in the Western world, so it's a lot of Australia, UK, and the US. And a big theme in this book is... basically an encouragement for people with disabilities to not be pregnant and to not have kids. But in your paper here, it was talking about how a woman with a disability without a child was viewed more negatively than a woman with a disability with a child, and that, like, cultural difference in perceptions around disability.
Well, yeah. Well, also, we often make distinctions between high and low and middle income countries that are misleading. And the assumption is that people with disabilities do better in higher income countries and worse in low and middle income countries. It really depends on the country, and not just the country, because it's usually not national. It's often by ethnic or minority group or tribal group. So we can't, you know, the assumption that we're setting somehow the bar in the United States or Australia and everybody will follow us. Mm-hmm. Very misleading for any number of things, not just disability. But importantly, in many parts of the world, having a child is the sign of adulthood. And many, many, many men and women with disabilities I speak to in countries will say, look, we don't have social security. There's no kind of, no social supports. In our old age, you know, mm-hmm. if we don't have children, then we're really, you know, we face extreme poverty and isolation. And so it's important to be realistic and to listen closely to people with disabilities in many countries in the country. It'll depend on what other social supports and networks are out there. But more than that, it depends on the individuals. Some individuals with or without disability want children, and it's an important part of their life. Some don't want children, and it's up to them, I think, again, we often will the responsibility of all of us in the medical profession and the social, you know, services in the general population and families. It's everybody's job to ensure that all young people or all people who may become sexually active have the information they need to protect themselves, to make decisions on their own behalf, and then to enable them to make those choices. But it's not our decision to make. It's the person with a disability, it's their decision to make.
Thank you. And thank you for talking on this. 100%. People should know what they should be able to do what they want with their own bodies. 100%. I wanted to, well, is there anything else you wanted to talk about your research and your experience? We may come back to it, but
I would say What the kind of research I do, and I hope lots of people do, is applied research. So I'm sympathetic. I don't do much myself. There are people who do lots of theoretical papers or come up with frameworks and designs. They're all important, but there's so few people actually working on global health in general and on disability specifically, that I'm a big fan of asking before you set out to do a project the basic mm-hmm. research question, and that's the question is so what. So it's someone's. Am I benefiting people's lives, or am I giving them greater decision making? Am I helping implement the program? Getting some nutritional deficiency that may be affecting people with disability mm-hmm. as they grow and move from adolescence to adulthood. It could be any number of questions, but you should always ask yourself who's going to benefit from the research you do. We just don't mm-hmm. have the luxury in this day and age to do research unless it really makes a difference. Actually, I'm a big proponent of saying that good research should make a difference, and really good research should cause trouble. And I hope that
most can I get that on a t-shirt, please?
Yeah, just quote me. And you should want to make a difference. You don't have to cause trouble in the sense of throwing things at people on podiums, although that's sometimes warranted. But you should be saying, I should be able to do enough with this question I'm asking and the data I'm gathering to convince people convince people with disabilities they need to ask for or seek specific services or supports mm-hmm. or changes in the law. I should be able to convince politicians. There are different, there's going to be different audiences for much research. No research is universal, or very little of it is universal. But, research on, what are we teaching medical students about disabilities such that they'll make a difference? That should be something we should think about before we set out mm-hmm. to do research. I mean, nobody just goes out to do research. You usually have a question you want to do.
Ideally, yes, ideally. I love that. What is your favorite trouble that you've caused with your really good research?
Well, I don't know if mine is really good research, and lots of people are doing research.
You're the one I'm interviewing.
It wasn't just my research, but as a researcher, there were some of us who were involved or pulled in with, it was led by disability advocates, but the effort to write and then pass and get ratified the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities was certainly, a lot of the research on AIDS I did was right mm-hmm. before we started to do some work on the CRPD, and 1.3 billion people mm-hmm. worldwide. And so as a researcher, again, I wasn't the lead on it. It was a disability advocates who put that together. Mm-hmm. But as a researcher, to be in the room and to help with the discussions, which went on for around 4 years, it was like mm-hmm. weeks at a time in the basement of the United Nations building in New York. Everybody would go down and sit there and work on one component or the next. I was on a bunch of committees. Everybody was on a bunch of committees. It was actually a very interesting exercise also because the first meeting was in, I believe, 2000, might have been the fall of 2000. Oh, no, maybe 2002. I'm sorry, my dates are getting muddled here. Advocates descended on the UN building in New York. It was in the main building in the basement where the General Assembly is. And at first, all the delegates, the international delegates from all the different countries who were just going in and out of the UN for work, would kind of stare at the disability advocates and hold the door open for them and make sure that they were being did they know where they were going. And it was really, they were just, the typical, let me be patronizing to you because you're a person in a wheelchair approach. And of course, these were like the world's, you know, these were disability advocates from all over the world. They were a no-nonsense bunch. I noticed, as anthropologists observe a lot, I noticed that by the end of the first meeting, these delegates were afraid to hold the door open or go anywhere near these delegates. They scared the hell out of the delegates. But after that, every time the delegates would show up, you'd see, you know, for the UN convention, show up all the, you know, advocates and the rest of us who were kind of tagging along, you'd see all the people who worked at the UN kind of avoiding, you know, they didn't know to hold the door open, not hold the door open. But they clearly reframed their attitudes towards people with disabilities. So that was a really interesting exercise in kind of how you can change the social, you know, the more people in a room you have with a disability, the more you can change a people.
It's an amazing story. I am 100%. And that's part of why, and this is not to get off topic, but like a lot of the work I do with like my disability organization, we're pushing for the inclusion of more disabled medical students because like that's how we're going to help abate some of the stigma and some of the false perceptions is if you have more people in medicine with disabilities, it stops being so us and them.
When I went off to college, I was an undergraduate at the University of Michigan. I remember that 4% of the medical school class was women and 96% was men. And as an undergraduate, all my friends who wanted to go to medical school who were women were competing. 50% of the competing for those 4% slots. And it was just hard to get it. It's never been, but now half of all medical school classes or more are women, and it's changed the tone, and it's no longer such a rarity. In fact, I knew my key informants on Martha's Vineyard. His grandmother and great aunt were the first two women doctors in the United States, the Blackwell sisters, and he told a story about how one of them. The first one was voted in by a medical school in New York as a joke, and she showed up anytime. She checked into her boarding house and went right off to the first day of classes. When she came back, all her suitcases and all her stuff was on the front porch of the boarding house because the woman found out that she was that medical student, and she didn't want an immoral woman staying in her house. So
an immoral woman? Oh my God.
That's... You know, this was a woman who'd actually seen naked men, you know, and
gasp.
And so things change. Things change, and the important thing to know is that things change, but they can change back. So not just making changes, but continual vigilance to ensure that you keep getting enough medical students with disabilities showing up, or you keep making sure that the outreach program you have that a representative number of people with disabilities continues to include them.
I think that's a really important comment, especially in today's political climate of like. Just because progress has been made doesn't mean that it can't be undone. Yeah. And we have to continue to strive.
Right. Nothing stays fixed.
Right. One of the great secrets of the world, or open secrets of the world, progress isn't linear.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly.
You've hinted a little bit at some of your career trajectory, but I was hoping we could talk more about it because you're someone who holds multiple academic appointments. You sit on a whole lot of committees. And I kind of wanted to talk about how you, like what advice you have for people earlier in their academic career about building a career trajectory that works for them.
I may not be the best. I mean, I wasn't a medical student, and I did go into medicine, which has a more, I won't say linear career trajectory, but it's
structured.
it's you're guaranteed a job when you graduate, which when you have a PhD in anthropology, you're really not guaranteed a job. So I'm probably not the best person to ask. And I always think of that old Mark Twain quote about if you don't know where you're going, you'll probably end up someplace else. So I finished my PhD at Brown University, and the next day was unemployed, and actually unemployed and at home with a newborn. And so I may never get a job as long as I live. One thing I'd say is kind of follow what you're really passionate about. Mm-hmm. Also take advantage of, someplace go. So mm-hmm. After I finished my doctorate, a couple of months afterwards, somebody invited me to come give an afternoon talk to the child abuse program at Harvard University. We're in Boston. It was at Boston Children's. And there was nothing on violence or domestic violence or abuse against children or adults with disabilities mm-hmm. at the time. So I thought this will be an easy talk to give. This would be like through a friend of someone who friend. And so I showed up, and there were like three, four people in the, it was a small mm-hmm. group. And I basically said, we know nothing about this entire group and no one's paying attention. So I gave one of these kind of, anything you do will be better than what's being done now, which is almost, or very mm-hmm. little. I didn't say mm-hmm. no one's paying attention, but it's a very limited literature. And about 2 months later, the head of the program called up and said, one of our postdocs in the child abuse program at Boston Children's can't make it. It's like September mm-hmm. and he's just pulled out. Would you like a postdoc at Harvard? And I thought, unemployment, postdoc at Harvard, unemployment. But I thought probably I should take the postdoc. and once I took the postdoc, and at the same about the same time, my PhD dissertation on the Martha's Vineyard deafness. And I started to get involved with people more internationally, both through the child abuse mm-hmm. stuff, but specifically I was looking at child abuse towards children with disabilities in low and middle income countries. Mm-hmm. And from there, I got a junior professorship, an assistant professorship. I stayed on as a research scientist at Harvard for a while, and I wrote and I did stuff and did an increasing amount of work with the disability advocacy community that was starting to get going in the late 80s. And an assistant professorship opened up at Yale University. And so I went to Yale and helped set up and run the global health program there for about 20 years. And then I got offered a professorship, a chair in the research mm-hmm. center at University College London, which is where I am now. But throughout all those years, I spent a lot of time getting involved in things, a lot of them around disability, that were, I thought, good research. Mm-hmm. A lot of it was not funded. A lot of it was just, I volunteered a lot of time for committees, for other things. I still do. Because it was interesting and I thought important to whatever expertise I had to lend it to those causes. If I waited around to be formally invited to give a keynote speech, I would have waited forever as a junior person. Funding is always important, but I was never great. I mean, I've gotten a number of grants over the years, but I never waited to get a grant in order to do research I thought was mm-hmm. important, and I find that generally if you're halfway through a project and you really know it well, you can describe what you want to do and get fun. But mm-hmm. I wouldn't wait for that. Publication is also, everybody says publish when you have something to say. It's a lot easier mm-hmm. to publish for the sake of publishing. But the career advice mostly I get is do what you're passionate about. If there's three projects and one really interests you and the other are kind of lackluster, not enthusiastic about it, do what you're really enthusiastic about.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I also like what you said about just showing up. I think we can kind of be scared sometimes to like put ourselves out there. But what's the worst that's going to happen? Somebody will say no.
Like, well, you don't have to. I mean, it's not just showing up to be part. You know, if someone's giving you an interest, talk, show up, and go up and introduce yourself. Speaking as an older professor now, there is nothing nicer in my mind than younger, enthusiastic, basically, you know, junior colleagues. If you're a medical student or a graduate student, as far as I'm concerned, you're a junior colleague. I'm going to, you know, run into you time and again, and it's really nice to meet younger, enthusiastic people. If you run into someone who's really established in the profession and who isn't nice, find someone else. You know, if someone's a grump, just ignore them and move on. But if there's someone you like or someone who seems responsive, you know, ask them if you could, you know, come by and just talk about a research idea, or do they think this is an important way to go, or ask for career advice. No, most people don't mind, and many people just feel that it's part of what they owe to the profession and part of what they owe to generations that have gone before us, who have given advice and guidance and support to us. So it's passing it along, I guess.
I have found so many people that want to mentor people. That's like, maybe not formally, maybe it's just a half hour talk here, half hour talk there. But I think we get a lot of talks at my stage about finding mentors. And I think there's this idea that it has to be some set, like, I will meet with you every Tuesday at 2 p.m. sort of thing. But realistically, I have found that if you do exactly what you just said, which is go up to people, email people, talk to people and be like, what you do is interesting. Can you tell me about how you got there?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about what you've done? It gives you some of that, and it builds those connections.
Medicine is a little different. I need a mentor, in part because what I was doing was a little different. I wanted to do applied. In an era where there weren't many applied research, I was a woman in an era where a few women were in academia.
Yes.
You know, and so there was not an older woman who was doing something that there were older men, and they were sometimes more helpful, but they had a much easier course. They didn't have to hustle as much jobs. So I never found.
I never had really a mentor.
I had some people whose work I really respected. So one was an oral historian at the University of Maine in Orono named Edward Sandy Ives. And I did a summer internship with him as a master's student. And he really taught me how to interview people. And he was just a lovely, he didn't do a health issue.
Rural New England, but that set me up for doing the research I did on Martha's Vineyard.
And it would have done when I was doing my research on Martha's Vineyard. I lived with an elderly fisherman and his wife, Gail and Mildred Huntington. And Gail was also the island fiddle player and the island historian. And he really helped me, not just in the sense of you should go speak to so-and-so. He'd drive me to interviews and sit around and kibitz with the people interviewing. I actually, the book I did on Martha's Vineyard, I dedicated to Gail. And so he was also someone who taught me how to interact with people at the community levels, how to be a good anthropologist, although he himself was just, someone who just spent most of his life on the vineyard and was like the local historian. But I, you know, what I learned from Gail, I use when I go to interview, I was talking before, we did this big project interviewing disabled street beggars on the streets of Addis Ababa. And I'd go out and sit down and interview the people who are begging on the streets. And a lot of what I could do in terms of that, or when I access to water and sanitation for people in rural Zambia. And in doing that, what I learned was based I learned from Gail Huntington and Sandy Ives.
I love that so much. I know I keep saying that whenever you tell a story or you give something, but I could just sit here and just listen to you because it's impressive, but also it's so real. Of course it is, it's your life, but like it feels, I think that the experience of learning from the people in our lives, even if they aren't specific, like experts in what they do, is so, I think, true to the experience of both being a human being, but being a human being in medicine, being a human being in academia. I think it's something that is undervalued and something that is like kind of crucial.
Yeah. You bring up a really important point. And I don't think what I've done is particularly impressive. I think that, you know, and being in academia, and I've been, you know, affiliated with a bunch of kind of well-known schools, but to be very honest, most people in the world don't see the great classroom, let mm-hmm. alone have the privilege of going on to high school or going on to a university or graduate or medical school. So the issue is not to sit and swan around and say, oh, I have a lot of education. The question always is what you do with the education you have to make a difference. You've been given that education, is not yours. It's kind of the collective knowledge base that you've been able to take part in. And so the issue really seriously is what you do to be a good clinician or a good researcher or to teach the next generation. It's not a question of sitting around going, oh, well, you know, I taught at Harvard, University College London or whatever.
Yeah, it's about doing the work and showing up and paying it forward, or paying it, not just paying it back, but paying it forward.
The real question is, what don't we know? Where are the gaps?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, that will keep you busy with a lot of research. You know, what don't we know? Because we don't know a lot more than we know right now. You know, and that may always be the goalpost may always mm-hmm. be moving, but we, you know, anybody, a student right now, or a junior, you know, a young professional in training, can sit down and say, oh, you know, I haven't read many papers on that. I looked it up and there was nothing there. Well, if there's nothing there, they don't have a lot of data. That should be a red flag saying, if you're interested in that topic, mm-hmm. go for it.
Yeah. Being able to see the lack of something, which is a learned skill. Being able to notice when something is missing or something isn't there.
It's actually common sense, even that. So
it is, but, and yet, the ability to go from it and be like, oh, I'm interested, there's nothing there, oh well, to I'm interested, there's nothing there, I could make sure that there's something there, I could do work. Like, that's a gap. Yeah.
Well, we're taught to go, you know, and the people who get to medical school or law school or get a PhD program or junior faculty, we're among the best in the world of going and looking up what's there. And say, oh, so-and-so, there are 5 papers on this. And what we're not taught the next step takes a little courage to say, wait, I just did a big review of X or Y or Z, and there are only 8 papers that I mm-hmm. can find in the future. And then of those, 4 are big pronouncements, but there's nobody mm-hmm. actually data on it. That is, you know, that is where you say, wait, more research needs to be done. Now, there are some fields that are over-researched. You know, everybody in the world has done something on name a number of fields, but we don't know. Mm-hmm. You need to go. But even in those fields, you can say, but no one's had this angle. So what you should look mm-hmm. for if you want to do kind of applied research is to say, what angles don't we know? You know, we know all this about women, but nothing about men in the same situation. Mm-hmm. Or we know a lot about children with disabilities in this situation, but no one's asking about what happens when they become adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to, you know, think what we don't know. And, you know, I have grad students all the time will come back they're doing a master's thesis or a PhD. They come back and they've just done a literature search, and they can only find, like, you know, 5 papers, 10 papers on the subject they want to study. And, you know, they come in dejected. And to me, that's a real, that mm-hmm. means something original. So mm-hmm. that's a good sign.
It's the reframing.
Papers that are there, and you don't mm-hmm. want to repeat someone else's research, but you know, ask a mm-hmm. question, you know.
I wanted to tie that back into what we were talking about earlier, to kind of tie this all together, which is, what do you think needs to be done in the field of disability and global health broadly?
Broadly is we
or need... It doesn't have to be broadly, sorry. What do you, like, where do you see, where would you like to see the field go?
I'd like to see, well, that's a good question. so many directions, but consistently what you find is that when you take any major global health question, there's mm-hmm. relatively little on people with disabilities as part of the mainstream discussion of that topic, be it tuberculosis or access to good prenatal care or mm-hmm. Traffic safety, or it doesn't matter. So I want disability to be part of mainstream research projects, and not just disability specific. When you talk about the twin track approach, where you have a disability specific mm-hmm. study and also a mainstream study, and you get some disability specific studies, and they're great, but in many major topics, you know, what do we know about cervical cancer globally? Well, some, not, we could learn a lot more. What do we know with women with disabilities and cervical cancer about their being tested or being treated? Mm-hmm. About, much less. So take any major global health concern you want, you know, be it malnutrition or climate change or cancer or Alzheimer's disease or aging, or, and then say, what do we know about people with disabilities, and make it part of the mainstream efforts, not just a, you know, kind of something off on the side.
I love that. But with that, I just wanted to thank you for coming today and for being on this podcast. I know you're very busy, and I really appreciate you taking time out of your life to talk to me and to share your lived experience and expertise with the American Medical Women's Association community.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.